I don't know if you've noticed, but a socialist architecture, so hot right now. Once dismissed as bleak and inhuman, the concrete relics of a failed political experiment, the concrete structures of vanished socialist states, that they've been saved somewhat by a resurgent fascination for mid-20th century modernism. Alongside that somewhat Instagrammy lifestyle fetishing, however, is a more serious critical reappraisal of socialist architecture. That's happening too. For example, a book based on an exhibition that was on at New York's MoMA. It's called Toward a Concrete Utopia, Architecture in Yugoslavia, 1948-1980. Its co-editor is Martino Steely. He's the Philip Johnson Chief Curator of Architecture and Design at New York's Museum of Modern Art. He joins us now. Martino, welcome.
Thank you. Hello.
Why this moment? Why this architecture? What is so compelling to you about this period in Yugoslav architecture?
Well, I think there's two reasons why I was compelled to work on this project. One is an academic one, and one is maybe more a political, contemporary one. The academic reason is that I feel that the history of modern architecture has been represented not to the full extent, globally speaking, as it should have. There are many sort of dark spots on the map of places that have produced highly significant work of modernist architecture in the 20th century, but which have just not been integrated into our sort of understanding of history. So that's the more academic answer. And the other answer, the more political one, is that I feel that architecture in our contemporary world has really lost much of its societal impact and has become more and more a luxury commodity at the hands of the happy few. And I think it's important at this time and age to reconsider that there are alternatives, that there are ways of thinking about the nexus between architecture and society, in which architecture can actually make a very meaningful contribution to an idealistic and progressive vision of what a society can be and should aspire to.
Yugoslavia, in this conversation, is a really interesting place. There it is, in so many ways, caught in that period in the mid-20th century between two worlds, caught between Soviet Russia, caught between the West, and a place that had aspects of both cultures.
That's absolutely right. Yugoslavia was one of the founding nations of the non-aligned movement, which precisely tried to situate themselves between the capitalist West and the communist East. Yugoslavia was expelled from the Warsaw Pact in 1948 and then rapidly opened itself to the West, but always negotiated between these two worlds, and then also opened itself up to many post-colonial, newly independent nations in Africa, where Yugoslav architects would also build massively in infrastructure projects. So it's also a very interesting, from that point of view, to consider this specific moment in history and Yugoslavia's contribution almost as a prehistory of the age of globalization that we are experiencing currently.
How self-conscious was this within Yugoslavia at the time, this sort of push towards being a modernist adventurism?
Well, so there was never sort of a state doctrine that, you know, architects should build modern. But of course, the regime and all the different organizations and institutions that stood behind this project of a utopian society were very aware that modern architecture could provide sort of an image for a society that would embody this progressive notion, this great push forward towards a newly industrialized and newly highly urbanized society. And they were very good at exploiting that capacity of modern architecture.
What do we know of the public reaction contemporaneously within Yugoslavia to this sort of new trend in building?
Well, that's a very difficult question that we very difficult to answer in retrospect. We do know that in the sort of in the media, in the more official representation, of course, it was almost glorified. It was seen as a great medium by which society could sort of find its new image. What is interesting to see, and that was also part of our exhibition, it's also discussed in our book, is how that whole massive undertaking of architecture at large scale became part of feature films, of TV series, and so on and so forth. And there's a sort of almost an ironic take that we often see that it's a really big topic that people, you know, many people coming from the countryside, moving to the city for the first time, experience these entirely new, highly dense urban spaces and all the sort of social conflicts that arise from it. And it's very much part of the social, of the narrative of this society in the 60s and 70s, which makes it so interesting.
It's such a fascinating contrast too with the place that architecture plays in our culture contemporaneously as a, you know, as a, an adjunct to a market-based development ethic, to have architecture coupled to a social project in this way is such an interesting contrast.
Absolutely. And that's why I think it's so important to do this kind of show and this kind of book precisely in this moment. It's not to say that the underlying political project was by all means successful, but it did produce some highly relevant work, and it particularly produced a notion of shared civic space and of a shared history in a multi-ethnic, highly diverse society that I think is very relevant for us to think about in our contemporary moment as well.
Let's get to cases. You should describe some of the buildings that we're talking about, if you could, Martina.
Well, we could, for example, talk about the many, many hotel projects along the Adriatic coast, Croatia, that were built in the 60s and 70s, and they were really part of a large regional development scheme in which the hotels would almost become social condensers for the local societies. What does that mean? Unlike in sort of capitalist development, where these hotels for foreign tourists were mainly seen as shut-off resorts, you know, behind high walls with only limited access or actually no access for the local populations, these hotels in Yugoslavia were always conceived as contributing to the social infrastructure of the existing villages and places where they were situated. So always the ground floor and the premises, including the interior spaces, were open to the public. The local people were actively invited to come and experience these spaces and to mingle with the foreign tourists. So we have a very interesting notion of sort of this creating this kind of shared space, this high care that is given to public space, which is even in evident in something like hotel and resort infrastructure, which, you know, is very unlikely in our contemporary world.
So Yugoslavia, of course, severed ties with the Soviet Union in 1948. How did this emerging architecture within Yugoslavia differentiate itself from the trends of Soviet architecture?
So the break with Stalin really meant a radical reorientation towards the West. In the early 50s, we see a very, very strong influence of the work of Le Corbusier. There's an exhibition that tours through the country, and we see immediate effects on the built environment in Yugoslavia, and that many, many architects directly reference things like the Unité d'Habitation in Marseille, which was, of course, also in a way a utopian vision of a social condenser in that many, many people were living in this one building. A bit later, we see more and more the influence of American international style architecture, the Museum of Modern Art, where I am working as a curator, sent a number of exhibitions that were curated in the museum to the region. And then we see that this international style with its glass facades and its steel construction also immediately has an impact on Yugoslav architecture culture. So Yugoslavia is really, really quite distinct from what's going on in the Eastern Bloc. Obviously, the Eastern Bloc also opens itself up to more international streams of architecture culture, particularly after de-Stalinization. But in Yugoslavia, what makes Yugoslavia unique is really that we have a consistent adherence to modernism throughout in all its various iterations.
It goes deeper, of course, than buildings. There's tremendously important design movement in train at the same time in Yugoslavia. We have a real richness around furniture and object design as well.
That's absolutely right. I think that's also quite clear from the catalogue that indeed this project of modernization and transformation of society was not just played out on the abstract level of urban planning and of architecture, but it was really a broad attempt to bring modernity through all kinds of everyday products into the households in the everyday life of Yugoslav citizens. We have fabulous 1960s designs for household appliances, for technical apparatuses such as TVs, microphones, video cameras, and so on and so forth, which are clearly absolutely contemporary to sort of the pop aesthetic that we see in Western consumer culture at the time. We also find highly flexible furniture design, such as the Rex folding chair by Niko Kral, a Slovenian designer that became very, very successful, ubiquitous, not only in Yugoslavia, but really in many parts of Europe as well. It was, for example, used as furniture in the University of Frankfurt in West Germany. In fact, it was recently re-edited by an American company, and we actually are selling it in the MoMA design store. So this is a great success story on an international level that Yugoslav design history actually lives on to the present day.
And of course, Yugoslavia in the late 20th century dissolves. I wonder that architectural legacy, it represents so much of sort of socialist universalism. How did that fare in these newly constructed states based around regional, ethnic, religious diversity, the Croatia, the Serbia? Is the architecture still held in respect, or is it seen to represent a thing that was fought against?
It's a good question. In fact, many or almost all the buildings that we showcase in the book and in the exhibition continue to exist and to continue to be used in their functions, sometimes also in altered functions. In some parts of former Yugoslavia, they're very well maintained. In other parts, of course, there's maintenance issues, which of course is not something specific to Yugoslavia. We have many of these concrete buildings, these brutalist buildings in particular, that pose a lot of challenges to preservation. And there is, I think, globally also a lack of appreciation of the great also aesthetic value that some of these buildings have. And so one thing that our book and our exhibition obviously is also trying to do is to raise an awareness for this unique legacy that we should try to preserve. What has come, of course, under a sort of heavy distress are the monuments, which are also a very important aspect of our project. Monuments commemorating the victims of fascist occupation in World War II were ubiquitous throughout Yugoslav territory and formed sort of almost the cathedrals, as it were, of identity formation of this multi-ethnic state. And of course, in the post-Yugoslav nationalist division, many of these monuments were increasingly seen as glorifying communism, which they really weren't, but because they were built in the socialist era, they were seen as that. And so many of these have been vandalized, destroyed, and are in general not in good shape. It's not generally true for all of them, but certainly to some.
Well, Martina, thank you so much. The book is Toward a Concrete Utopia, Architecture in Yugoslavia, 1948-1980. And Martino is its co-editor. Thank you so much for your time.
Thank you very much.
Martino Stierli, he's the Philip Johnson Chief Curator of Architecture and Design at New York's Museum of Modern Art.